This episode, Justice League America number 60, cover dated March 1992. Breakdowns, part 15. Hello, and welcome to the 60th episode of Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name is the Iridium Shag, and I am your host, but I'm not doing this alone, folks. Thankfully, today I am joined by an amazing guest to help me cover the final issue in the original run of Justice League by Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis. My co-host today is a returning guest to the show and also a superstar writer. He's known for creating characters for incredibly successful television shows and movies, but to most of you, he's probably best known as the writer of some fantastic comic books. You know, he's had lengthy runs on a whole bunch of mainstream books, you know, things like Adventures of Superman, Uncanny X-Men, Cable, Wildcats, G.I. Joe, and a whole bunch more. And he's also found tremendous success with creator-owned works such as Godland, Officer Down, Butcher Baker the Righteous Maker, and the series simply entitled Sex. And along with his partners, he helped found the group Man of Action Entertainment, which has been responsible for such massive, massive animated hits like Ben 10, Generator Rex, Big Hero 6, and even launched animated series for Marvel's Ultimate Spider-Man and Avengers Assemble. Folks, please help me welcome back Mr. Joe Casey. Welcome to the Secret Sanctuary, Joe. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, Shag. Thanks for having me. It's slightly bittersweet on several levels, but it's going to be fun.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it's been 5.5 years since we've chatted, which is absolutely insane. You know, the before times, before the COVID and all that. But for the show, I mean, this has been 8 years in the making, getting to this issue. You know, we started this, I can't believe it's 8 years, been doing this, finally reached the end of the Giffen DeMatteis run. Now, for those of you at home, I've already had people asking me, is this the last episode? No, the podcast is still going. We've got 9 more episodes. We're going to cover, you know, the I Can't Believe It's Not the Justice League, formerly known as the Justice League. We're going to talk about toys. We're going to talk about cartoons. We got lots to talk about. So we're going to keep going until August 2024. But this one, I mean, this is a big, big moment. So I'm assuming you bought this off the shelf. How did you come to this one?
I bought it off the shelf. I was there to the bitter end, from JL number 1 to JLA number 60. I was there every month.
It's such a great series, too. And so as a writer of some incredibly, you know, well-known stuff, do you feel like the JLI had any influence on the direct? Was it just something you love, or do you feel like it influenced your writing any kind of way?
It influenced me in really subtle ways. I've looked back on it, not necessarily directly, because there was a style that I appreciated, but never really tried to mimic in my own writing. But there were tonal shifts in that series over the course of the 5 years that I really appreciated and appreciate more and more looking back as a writer, that I think is the series is underrated for some of its tonal shifts. I mean, everybody remembers the basic humorous tone, but when it got dramatic, it really worked for me. And that kind of shift going from one extreme to another in a single series, it really showed the breadth of what a superhero comic could contain in terms of moods and emotions. And I mean, it really ran the gamut. It wasn't just a humor book in the slightest to me.
Yeah, I went back and listened to our last conversation. I remember that is one of the things you said, was that the comedic aspects of the League wasn't what you necessarily connected with the most. You said you preferred the action adventure stuff, and then that was in there too. So Breakdowns, right, is completely different, right? Because I mean, there's not as much humor. There's a lot of dark stuff going on. So I'm curious your thoughts on Breakdowns. Like, how does that play into your love of more of the action adventure stuff in this series? Is that, I don't know, do you see any difference in the tone of Breakdowns versus the rest of it?
Well, ironically, yes. I mean, to me, Breakdowns, first of all, it lasted quite a while. I remember yeah. On and on and on. And it was a little dour. And I think also that was because I knew the run was coming to an end. So mm-hmm. Those emotions were tied up in the reading of the text, where you knew it was coming to an end point. And you just were girding your loins for not having this fix every month, you know? So it was a somewhat of a funeral procession and quite a long one. So it was almost like a very drawn out agony, I remember at the time.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
And rereading it now, going month by month, doing every issue, I've finally, and this kind of sparks off something you said when we talked the last time. You talked about three-act structure with Justice League specifically. And I realized as I went through this that Giffen probably planned this out, it breakdowns itself in a three-act structure, because the first 5 or 6 issues are all about Bialya, right? And then yeah. The middle 5 are all about the UN screwing them around. And then the last five are about the stuff going on with Dream Slayer and shutting it down. So it's almost like they were very purposely laying that out in such a fashion. But yeah, 15 parts was a long haul. I remember even back then it was a long haul.
Yeah. I mean, and clearly they had a lot of ground to cover. And I'm glad in a sense that they took that time, because even though I probably moaned about it at the time and remember that feeling of it dragging on, it was sort of the necessary emotions that as a reader you had to go through. Mm-hmm. It was a proper way to send off the series, or at least this iteration of it. And it did give you the time to wallow in your misery. And I do appreciate that in hindsight, because you know, these comics, the most they can promise you is some sort of experience, mm-hmm. whether good, bad, or, you know, misery or the heights of happiness or the, you know, throes of ecstasy. This one was sort of all in one because it had the time to fit it all in. But yeah, I'm not sorry that I had the experience that I had with it, even though at the time I was, you know, questioning it a little bit.
And I do think if they had broken up Breakdowns into three chunks, it'd been like, I don't know, gave it a subset name, kind of like they did it with what, Nightfall and Night Quest and all that, where they had, you know, segmented portions of it. It might have been easier for us to swallow if we knew it was a five-issue chunk and a five-issue chunk. But either way, it is what it is.
That's probably exactly right. But yeah, but I'm, you know, again, It was a unique experience to have in comics, this sort of long, drawn-out goodbye. So I appreciate having had it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We joke on the show, it's a little bit like Return of the King or David Tennant's leaving Doctor Who. It's just they revisited all the greatest hits right here at the end. So
Right, exactly.
So I want to talk with you, because I mean, we've talked about you being a comic writer, but we haven't talked about what you're working on right now. So you've got a couple of books in the pipeline about to come out from some mainstream publishers. Is that right?
That's correct. I'm back in it.
So what brought you back to comics, for starters, and then tell us a little bit about Dutch and tell us a little bit about Neil Before Zod.
Well, I never went away. It's just I wasn't so focused on having things out on the stands. I've been banking a lot of material, which will be coming out over the next couple of years.
Awesome.
Dutch is one of them. Dutch is not necessarily an update, but catching up with an old character from the original Image Comics universe. Dutch was a member of Team Youngblood back in 92, 93. And this miniseries that's coming out starting in February catches up with him 30 years later in real time. So we get to see not only what he's up to, but what the Image Comics universe is sort of up to in that time.
Interesting. So do you guys worry about continuity at that point? Or because I'm trying to think if any of the Youngblood characters are still active. I mean, I guess Spawn interacted with them, but maybe not necessarily. Like, you know, how does that work on that side of it?
Let's just say I worry about continuity because it's a puzzle that needs to be put together. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the project is putting together the pieces when there are certain elements of the Image universe that aren't applicable anymore because of legal situations. So it's like putting a puzzle together where you don't have all the pieces. So we have to create some new pieces, and that's been a lot of fun.
Okay.
And very Giffen inspired, which I'm sure we'll get to later.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And then over at DC, you're working on Neil Before Zod. What an amazing name for a book. Yeah. I mean, did they give that to you or did you ask for it? Because that's awesome.
I give them all the credit for coming up with it. You know, it's one of those things where you're surprised that someone hasn't had it before now, a book titled Neil Before Zod, but there's never been a Zod book.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, his time has come it's been a fun project. Starts in January, drawn by artist Dan McDade, who I've worked with in the past. Mm-hmm. And the elevator pitch for Neil Before Zod is really just bad things happening to bad people.
Okay.
It is truly a supervillain book. We're setting Zod up to be the bastard he was always meant to be, and using this first year of stories to set him up to be what he always should be, which is Superman's opposite number.
As a fan, that is so exciting to hear you say you're setting up a whole year's worth, because so much nowadays is like a 6-issue run or something like that. And we're talking about this book, right? That went 60 issues, right? So I mean, we're all came up on books that last a while. And so to hear that you've got at least a year of story runway ahead of you is so exciting to hear.
Yeah, I've just finished the script for number 7, and the first issue comes out in January. So we're full steam ahead.
I was reading a little bit of the hype online, and some of the description calls it, quote, the most brutal series you'll read this year. And then it said, quote, from the sick and twisted minds of Adventures of Superman writer Joe Casey. So that sounds cheerful, Joe.
Well, I wrote that hype copy.
All right. Well, the art I've seen, the early art, I guess the six covers or five covers, I can't remember, but they all look amazing. It looks like it's going to be a phenomenal series. So excited for this, man.
It's gonna tap into some of the cosmic aspects of the DC universe. So that's been a lot of fun. I've never really played in that sandbox before and going to take full advantage. And like once again, there is some prime Keith Giffen influence in some of these issues that I've got coming up.
Oh, that's phenomenal. So how is that different for you when you're tackling, like, you know, this commercially mainstream product like Ben 10 or working on Marvel's, you know, Avengers cartoons or whatever, versus playing in the DC or even the Image sandbox? I mean, how different is that? Do you approach the project?
Well, I can tell you when it comes to comic book universes and comic book continuity, that's just what I've grown up with. That's in my DNA, that kind of problem solving, that kind of working under the shared universe concept. Mm-hmm. It's just, I know it like the back of my hand. I know how to maneuver in those worlds. I know how to deal with those, you know, the disparate elements that make up a shared universe. I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. So unlike something like Ben 10, which is sort of making those things up as you go, to plug into the DC universe in something like Neil Before Zod is like coming home, really, in terms of, you know, how I deal with it and the demands on my skills as a writer. Those are the skills that I've cultivated since I was 5 years old.
Okay. And it makes perfect sense, too. Right. I mean, it's the sandbox we all grew up in. So, yeah. Well, folks, what we're going to do in just a minute here, we're going to talk a lot about Keith Giffen and some thoughts about him. Before we do that, I got to pay the bills real quick. I do want to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of the JLI podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collectations, all for up to 45% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, this episode, I wanted to pimp a particular book called Godland, Volume 1, Hello Cosmic Trade Paperback. This is an Eisner Award nominee. Written by, some guy named Joe Casey, maybe?
Wow.
That guy knows how to put pen to paper.
I do recall writing this, actually.
With art by Tom Scioli. I hope I got that right.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Page count, 144 pages. And folks, this thing is such a trip. I mean, if you have ever loved anything Jack Kirby did, especially maybe the Marvel crazy stuff he did, this thing is right up your alley. It's been praised by folks like the Jack Kirby Collector, Entertainment Weekly. I just told you it's an Eisner Award nominee. It is a fantastic series. It follows some bonkers adventures. I think you once described it as turning Kirby into a genre, I think is how you said it one time.
Correct, exactly.
And that's what it feels like. It's so much fun. The art on the page just explodes. The characters are a trip. I've read this thing a couple times now and really enjoy it. And folks, you can get it right now for only, it's normally $14.99, but on InStock Trades, it is 45% off right now. So it's only $8.24. And this is just the first of, like, I think six volumes for you to jump into. And it is absolutely phenomenal. I highly recommend it. And it's a great book. So folks, for these and all your trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Also, this episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running our network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we need a little help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon. You folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying shows like the JLI podcast, the best way to support us is by visiting our Patreon at patreon.com/FWpodcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the show. And in certain tiers, get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be mentioned on the JLI podcast. So our thanks to Bill Beer, Chris Lewis, David A. Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Doug Adamson, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Michael Zomkowski, Roger Priebe, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWpodcast. All right, so this is normally the part of the show where I talk with a guest about their origins, with them finding the JLI comic. But, you know, hey, folks, you can go back and listen to the episode that we recorded back in March 2018, insane that is that long ago, talking about Justice League International number 17, where Joe shared his JLI origin. Instead, we wanted to take some time talking about, you know, this titan of the comic book industry, Mr. Keith Giffen. So, Joe, you know, first off, obviously he's been an influence on your writing, and I believe you've even worked with him on a project. Is that right?
I did. We worked together for a couple of issues of a series called Last Defenders, which came out the Marvel book from around 2008. I got to know him a few years before that, and we finally got to work together. But just knowing him and talking about certain different projects that we wanted to do together and finally getting to work together was a dream come true on so many levels. in my career, I've only worked with a few of my heroes. I've made it a practice not to, because I wanted them to stay my heroes.
Okay.
But Keith fulfilled every sort of childhood fantasy of working with a guy like him. And it was just the greatest thing. I treasure that brief interaction with him. But, you know, I got to do it. I got to cross it off my bucket list. And it was amazing. And, you know, it was the fulfillment of a dream that I had had from when I was a kid reading Justice League, which was, it seemed like the best gig in comics would be to collaborate with Keith Giffen, get his mind on a story, get his storytelling, get his breakdowns, to script off his breakdowns. That's exactly how we worked on Last Defenders. And it was just, it was amazing. I loved it.
So was it, because I actually read the Last Defenders just recently, getting ready for this. And what a fun series. I mean, that was great. So was it, so he did the plot and then did breakdowns, like just like he did with DeMatteis, is that right?
Well, it wasn't quite the same. We plotted it together.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went off and did the breakdowns, and I scripted the breakdowns. So it was,
okay.
It was a slight alteration, but as soon as we figured out the plot and then he went off to do the breakdowns, I would try to forget that I had anything to do with the plot. Just let the breakdowns come, and then I could be Jam DeMatteis in that moment and say, oh, here's this great thing that I get to script hold. And it was such a pleasure, such a fun time.
Oh, wow. And the book really, I don't want to call it a success, like a spiritual successor to JLI, but there's fun, there's action, there's, you know, it's a great, I mean, the art was fantastic too. So you get a lot of the great facial expressions. It really, I don't know, it felt comfortable. It felt like a comfortable pair of shoes, let's put it that way, to slip into as I read that story. And it really shined through. So what a great opportunity to collaborate with him. So you said you had met him a couple years before that. So was that at like conventions? Is that just hanging around the DC office? Were you just littering in front of his house? Like, how did you get to know him?
Nothing that twisted. I actually, he actually did a Godland, one of the few Godland variant covers.
Ah.
So, and that was hooked up by Eric Larson, who was Image publisher at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of my in to at least talk to Keith and get to know him. And then we started talking about, you know, possible collaborations, because if Keith was probably the greatest collaborator that mainstream comics ever produced. I mean, he would get excited about working with, I mean, excited being a relative term with Keith, but he was open to collaborating with, seemed like just about anybody that had a good idea that he felt like he could sink his teeth into. So we talked about a couple of things over the years before the Last Defenders project materialized.
Wow. So what would you say some of the work that he had done influenced you the most?
Well, I mean, Keith has been in my life as a creator ever since I started reading comics. One of the first comics I remember reading and loving was him on All-Star Comics in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
You know, inked by Wally Wood. I mean, I didn't even know creator from creator, but I loved those comics. I loved those few issues that they did together. So, and that was, I mean, those are some of the first comics I read. I was probably 5 or 6 years old reading those comics. And from there, it went to, you know, Legion of Superheroes with Paul Levitz, the Dr. Fate strips and the backups of the Flash comic. And he just was always there. And the best part about Keith is that he would reintroduce himself to the readers with these different styles, these different art styles. He'd reinvent himself every couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like being on a ride with somebody that you trusted, even if he took you to some wild places. So by the time he landed on Justice League, I was just primed to like live in his mind for the next, you know, 5 years. And so his work on Justice League, it showed me what collaborations could be, as opposed to just writer, artist, inker, you know, whatever. The fact that he was plotting, when I found out how he crafted the book, doing the breakdowns, it was a fascinating process story for me. And then, you know, he dropped the big one, which was the 5 years later Legion.
Yeah.
Which, huge influences on my work to this day. Even at the time, I was blown away by it. I put 5 years later Legion in the same category as all of the revolutionary DC work, from Swamp Thing to Dark Knight Returns to all the post-Legends revamps of all the main heroes. You know, the Byrne Superman, Batman 1, Perez's Wonder Woman, Barron's Flash, Suicide Squad, all those things that were groundbreaking it in different ways. And, you know, Giffen's Legion was one of those groundbreaking books that did so many things that challenged the reader, but, you know, did not betray your trust ever. And that's a hard line to walk when you're trying to do something that pushes the envelope a little bit, but maintain that bond with the core audience, or at least the fans of that IP. And I remember there being a lot of doubters.
Oh yeah.
When those first few issues came out, of things being hard to digest or hard to understand, or, you know, where were the characters we knew and loved? Well, they were all there. Everything was there. You just had to pay attention. And I was not even a dyed-in-the-wool Legion fan. I mean, I'd read the Giffen issues that he'd drawn with Paul Levitz, but that was kind of it. And so I certainly had to play catch-up as much as anybody else did, but I knew that I was in good hands. That was the best thing about Keith's work, is that even when it seemed on the surface look like it was going off the rails, I always knew I was in good hands. That's when you've bought stock in a creator for life, is when you feel like whenever you come to his work, you feel like you're in good hands.
That's a good summation. And one of our listeners of this show, I'm going to steal a quote from him. He said, a Keith Giffen book requires you pay attention. Which I just think is so true, because you talked about the lead. I'm going to talk a lot about the 5 year later Legion for a second, because like that 9-panel grid. I mean, you had to learn Keith's language really to understand those books, and once you got it and like unlocked it, it was amazing. It was so fulfilling. And for me, I hadn't really read any Legion. I was aware of them, like the Cosmic Boy miniseries or something or whatever. But right. The 5 year later Legion, I saw that ad. It was like that fold out thing you get in the store, and I was like, wow, this looks really cool. So I picked up issue 1. I did not know what the hell I was reading. You know, I had no idea what the hell was going on. But I was totally in. I'm like, Rock Crin? I don't know who that is. You know, and I would read each issue. And this is how much I, like, his storytelling spoke to me, even though I had no idea the subject matter. I would sit there and make copious notes. Every character, like Rock Crin, I got to figure out who that is. You know, every planet, everything that was in there. And then I would go to my Who's Who and literally research all of it. I would find every Legion entry and just flip back and forth till I found the names I was looking for. It was like one of the most rewarding and fulfilling, like, reading or research projects I ever did as a kid. I guess I was in high school at this point. But it was so rewarding. And like you said, as a reader, you were in safe hands.
Let me tell you, having done a couple of issues of Neil Before Zod that employed that 9-panel grid, that is a tough road to hoe. That takes intense concentration, and the fact that he committed to that 9-panel grid over, you know, several years of that comic takes a discipline and a commitment that is hard to come by. Because I just finished the 7th issue script, and it employs the 9-panel grid quite heavily. And it was one of the more exhausting comic book writing experiences in recent memory, just to keep it up and to keep it flowing and to keep it working. So the fact that he did it seemingly so effortlessly, because he was obviously doing other things at the time, like Justice League,
right,
amazes me. So he was literally, storytelling was just in his blood, because you don't just come to a 9-panel grid naturally. It takes a lot of forethought and a lot of effort to keep that thing working page after page after page. And he did it.
And you've probably got to be really careful with your dialogue, right? I mean, like, because there's only so much space. I mean, how much space can you fit in a 9-panel grid on each panel? So if you get too wordy, you're pushing all the art out. And like Tom and Mary Beerbaum, who worked with them on 5YL, they were some wordy writers. I mean, goodness gracious. You look at their Who's Who entries. They're like the longest Who's Who pages ever done. And I love it for it. I love that. I was there for it. But that had to be like just so hard to keep ratcheting it back and ratcheting it back and just finding words to cut and just to make the dialogue and the art work together. And it did. It sang. That book sang.
Yeah. I've never been more of an editor of my own work than I have been writing these two issues that involve me on a grid. It takes discipline, you know?
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's so many other great, and I'm not going to list every book the guy ever did, but you already named some. I mean, JLI, obviously, with 5YL we talked about. For you non-Legion folks, that's Legion, sorry. It's our acronyms we know. You know, the 1970s All-Star Comics you talked about, the Dr. Fate backups were great. You know, then Ambush Bug, oh my gosh, I mean, that's a thing unto itself, right? You know, Invasion, what an incredible springboard for so many things that came out of DC. You know, the acronym Legion, Lobo, for God's sakes. You know, one of the things I like to sing the praises of is that 12-issue Suicide Squad series he did in the 2000s, right after our Worlds at War. Like, not a lot of people remember that. It's the one where Sergeant Rock came back, kind of, sort of. That thing was great. I mean, it was the balance of Ostringer Suicide Squad with a little bit of JLI humor. You know, it was just pitch perfect.
Yep.
And then, of course, Heckler and Hero Squared and 52. All right, so, and I don't know all the inner workings. You know, 52 was a brainchild of like four guys, as I understand it. And as I understand it, Keith's kind of what that kept that train going.
Yeah, he was the glue that kept that series together. I can tell you, hearing it firsthand, that if it wasn't for Keith, that thing would have gone off the rails several times because he provided that consistency. He was the 30,000-foot view of the whole thing. He did layouts for every issue. He was able to bring consistency to four writers, kind of jamming on different scenes and different issues. And the consistency of that title over those whole that whole year was really down to Keith. You know, and I think they would say the same thing, all four of those writers.
And that book still holds up as an amazing, you know, first of all, it's a great read, but an amazing accomplishment that they are able to crank that out every single week. I mean, you guys were doing it with Superman for a long time, but you each kind of had your own corner, if I remember right. Like you had your own corner of the Superman universe to play in. It had to be a different dynamic, I would imagine.
Yeah. And also, I can't imagine, because I'm sure it was things that will never be reported, but I'm sure when those guys and Keith were in the room planning this thing out, that the ideas that Keith probably just contributed probably off the top of his head, I'm sure he was spinning gold there too. So big influence on that series, immeasurably, I think.
So those are just like some of the things. I mean, there's a million other books out there. Goodness gracious. You know, you can just look at everything he's done and everything he touched was gold. I mean, sure, there were some that may not have been up your alley, but you know what? It's like what they say about you wait 30 seconds, another bus will show up, you know, whatever. I mean, he had another idea right around the corner, you know, that was going to blow you away. And I've said this a little bit before on the show, but I'll tell you guys if you haven't heard it, but like, I always hope to have Keith on the show someday, like, but I could never get up the courage to ask him. You know, we've had Bart Sears on the show. We've had JM DeMatteis. We've had all kinds of comic creators. We've got you, Joe. We've got lots of comic creators, but I never got the courage to ask Keith. And people even offered to introduce, make a connection for me. And I was like, I'm not ready. I don't know. Because like, I watched a lot of interviews with him on YouTube. I read a lot of interviews. I mean, Keith was intimidating. You know, like, if you watch those interviews, he's always so frank and he's so honest and blunt, like in a glorious way. He just cuts through the bullshit, right? In every conversation to get to the point of what you're really supposed to be talking about, which is, you know, making comics is a job. And it was always fascinating to watch that. And it scared me. I never got a chance to correspond with him. I never got a chance to meet him at a convention, any of that. So I don't even know if he knows the show existed or anything. And it's pretty much the show is a testament to him and everyone else in the book. So I regret not having a chance to invite him. But like, so I'll ask you, since you've known the man, I mean, the gruff exterior he would give off in like convention interviews, is that really him? Or is that a partially, you know, I don't know, what was your experience with him?
Well, I mean, even an act has got a grain of truth in it. The thing about Keith that was so great is that he was not overly impressed with himself. And, you know, so he was, I wouldn't say he was devoid of ego, but he was devoid of ego in the way that you want someone to be devoid of ego, you know, which is that he knew his value, but he knew everybody's value, you know, he seemed to put them all on the same level. And that was nice to see, because when I met him and was talking to him, this was the mid-aughts, and he was a giant in the industry already. But you wouldn't know that from talking to him. You know, he never rested on his laurels. He never rested on his reputation. The things, I mean, people forget he was the translator of the Battle Royale manga.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, that was a big deal at the time. And he would be the last person that you would think would have that job and do that gig as well as he did. But he was way into it. So he was really ahead of the curve on that to a great extent. So, you know, he just was such a forward thinker and always looking for, you know, what's next? Where could we take something that hasn't been taken somewhere before? And I really admired his way that he never thought that he was the legend that he obviously was to all of his fans and to me, certainly. He just was a guy who wanted to make comics and wanted to work in comics. And the fact that in doing so, pioneered all these, you know, different characters and different ways of depicting the characters and creating new iterations of the characters. You know, the Blue Beetle that he created, they made a movie about it. Him being involved in the Marvel cosmic stuff right around that same time that I knew him basically led to the Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, he's a stealth genius, Keith Giffen. You know, I mean, everything that he touched, really, even when, if at the time you thought, well, this is nice, but who knows what the legacy is going to be. Everything has a legacy that he's worked on. Everything.
Wow, that really summed up so much about what I've heard about Keith and the legend that he is. And I can't think of a better way to cap that conversation than what you just shared. So thank you. And thank you for sharing your personal experiences with us. I mean, I think that's going to mean a lot to the people at home. And he's an incredible writer. I mean, this show spent the last 8 years celebrating, you know, something that he was deeply involved with plotting and creating. And what an amazing guy.
Yeah, we're not going to see his like in our industry again. He was one of a kind and literally a giant in our industry. It's, you know, we salute him every day.
Well, and the industry is so different now, too. I mean, so many people might not want to give their best ideas to the mainstream companies now. And
that's true.
Yeah.
I know from firsthand experience. Right.
So, yeah, I think you're right. I don't think we're going to see his kind again. And well, you know what? The best way we can do this is celebrate this comic. Let's do that. So why don't we talk about Justice League America number 60, the final issue in the Giffen DeMatteis original run. Now, we are going to get to visit them again when they come back in years later. But we'll for now, this is the original run. So this was published by DC Comics, cover dated March 1992, was on the shelves January 21st, 1992. Cover price, 4 shiny quarters, $1. I can't imagine getting this much entertainment for $1.
Wow.
Crazy. Cover is by the astonishing Kevin Maguire and Terry Austin, the guys who did the very first issue. You want to kind of describe the cover for us a little bit?
Well, it's to me, I always looked at it as sort of like a twisted propaganda poster, you know, and here's a hot take. These six characters on the cover, I remember at the time, and now I can really put it into focus. This was a sort of a prime example, again, hot take here, but the cover of issue one of Justice League from 1987 had Batman, Captain Marvel, Dr. Fate, you know, some heavy hitters. This cover is, to me, lacking in heavy hitters.
Oh, okay.
And I remember at the time when I took this off the rack and saw the lineup, it sort of illustrates where this series had gone from its original intentions.
Okay. I see what you're putting down. Yeah.
You know, these guys are not iconic. They're characters that we've come to know and love. But what happens with almost every team book, and certainly it happened with every iteration of the Justice League up until that point, writing a team book is a real juggling act, especially if you're dealing with characters that have their own books. So every writer or creator who works on these team books always longs for having a cast that no one else can put their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that cast. This is the winnowing out of all the other IP characters that other editors could give them static about or dictate in some way. These are the characters that they could have their way with. Then that there's good and bad to that. There, you know, as a creator, it's the freedom you want.
Right.
You know, you don't have to answer to anybody. From a commercial sense, I have to admit there's something lacking when Batman's not there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's something lacking when some of the bigger names aren't there. So this is it's sort of a bittersweet, again, cover for me because it exemplifies the best and the not the worst, but the realities of writing a team book for a major company. I mean, it's just right there.
So I'll argue with you a little bit on this. So you're right. I mean, the characters are Martian Manhunter, Guy Gardner, Fire, Blue Beetle, Ice, and General Glory, right? None of them have headlined a movie, you know, well, Blue Beetle, kind of, sort of. But, you know, they're, as you said, not the major IPs. But interestingly enough, even though they were playing, right, with the second, maybe third string characters, this was the first time Justice League was strong enough to have three books on the shelf. I mean, you had Justice League, America, Europe, and Quarterly. So while they weren't, I think because of the magic of the creative team is what it boils down to, they were able to make those second string, third string characters so interesting that that's why they were able to spin off and spin off and spin off. That's my take on it. But you're right. I mean, any cover of General Glory on it is not going to make you go, oh yeah, let's go. You know, it's not the team that's going to be leading the charge to the sales register. But you make a lot of interesting points, too, about how they have to deal with the characters they're given. I mean, Andy Helfer used to say in interviews all the time about these were the characters we were allowed to play with. I mean,
Right. And I don't blame them one bit.
Yeah.
I don't blame them one bit. But, you know, it's just an interesting sort of bookend to put this cover up next to the first Justice League cover from 87. You know?
Right. A lot more. It's funny. The first issue, they look kind of angry, right? They look tough. They look like they're ready for a fight. Here, there's a whole bunch of smugness going on here. You know, Guy's got a smirk. He looks very smug. Fire looks kind of alluring. You know, Beetle's kind of being like a goofy smile. And of course, General Glory looks like a normal self. And it's funny. I mean, obviously, McGuire's amazing with faces, and each one is so distinct. And the flags. We haven't even mentioned the flags across the top. So the ceiling is almost like ceiling tiles are covered with flags from different nations. So kind of an echo back to issue 7, I think it was, when it went international with all the flags.
That's
so,
right. Yeah.
Very stunning.
No, I mean, you can't fault the execution. I mean, it's McGuire and Terry Austin coming back too for Swan Song, which is also great because he did the first issue as well.
Yeah. So, all right. Speaking of the execution, so here's where things get a little strange is, and this was pointed out to me by one of our listeners named Jake Muir. A few other people have pointed out to me over the years too, but there is a version of this cover that is drawn by Chris Sprouse, which there's not a lot of data on it, as far as I know, at least, but it appears that Sprouse drew his version of the cover first. It's the layout. He's got all the notes to the colorists and everything. It's the same layout. I mean, all the characters are in the same position. Very, very similar. They've got the flags across the ceiling exactly the same. So it almost appears that Chris Sprouse did the design for this cover, and then the last minute, DC gave it to McGuire. At least that's how I'm reading it. You got a different take on that?
No, that's got to be it. And I never knew about that Sprouse cover, but it's amazing because it's great. It's just as great as the McGuire cover to me.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know what the story behind that was. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, it was just a sense that if McGuire was able to do it, then they had to give it to him.
Yeah.
And maybe they just didn't know if he would be able to do it or not, you know?
That seems like a very likely theory. There are some things about the Sprouse cover I actually kind of like better. Some of the body language, like Guy's got his fingers like hooked in his belt. He is like, there's a certain amount of swagger there with Guy. And Martian Manhunter's got his arms crossed like he's just over it, you know, which is typically his behavior. You know, and I just, there's a little bit of playfulness, I guess, more so in that cover.
I kind of buy Beetle's overweightness a little more on the Sprouse cover than I do on the McGuire cover.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. More of a wrestler's body. That's kind of gone to seed than the sort of the beer gut that McGuire gives him.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. I kind of really want to see the Sprouse cover colored now. Like, you know, it's inked, so there's no reason someone couldn't drop it in Photoshop, play around with the colors. Hint, people at home. would love to see that. And then I just, as we're talking, I just noticed something I never picked up on before. Justice League, the logo is in black.
Yeah.
And I don't think they've ever done that. I mean, having done the series for 8 years, I don't think I've ever seen that. So it is a little, you know, funeral-esque, you know, saying this is the end.
Yeah, for sure.
It's got to be. Sure. Wow. Great cover. Absolutely great. McGuire didn't knock it out of the park, and so did Sprouse. I mean, I love them both. So let's get into this. So it is the original team from Justice League number one back together one more time. Plot by Keith Giffen. Script by GM DeMatteis. Penciler's Kev McGuire. Inker is Terry Austin. Letter is Bob LePan. Colorist is Gene D'Angelo. Assistant editor is Kevin Dooley. And editor is Andy Helfer. It is Breakdowns Part 15. The issue is called Swan Song. So we start off in Maxwell Lord's apartment, and his girlfriend Wanda awakens to find Max is missing from the bed. He's been awake for a while, and he's distraught about what Dream Slayer did while possessing Max's body. Now, he's so upset that he actually goes for a walk, almost storming out. He visits the devastation of the old embassy, and a policeman there tries to run him off, but he recognizes him and says, "Oh, aren't you?" And Max says, "No, I just look like him."
That's a grim shot of the embassy wrecked.
Oh, it really is.
Well, it's just, you know, he's under the street lamp. It's just very moody. And it's one of those where the picture says 1,000 words kind of.
Oh, yeah. There's actually a lot of that in this issue where there's no words and they just let the art do the work. It's really impressive. Going back a little bit on Wanda. So it's interesting. Wanda was introduced in an issue where Max actually used his brain pushing powers to break the ice with her, which sort of becomes super uncomfortable when you really think about it. But now they're still together, and which is, I guess, says a lot, especially since Max doesn't have these powers anymore. He's pointed out here. So, you know, maybe he only meant, this sounds terrible. I can't believe I'm going to say the sentence. Maybe he only mentally manipulated her the one time. So maybe that's, wow. Yeah. There's no good way to put that. But anyway.
I think he's mentally manipulating her to be attracted to him in that sweater.
So, all right, if you had to say, because and now it's 1992 to be fair, it's not the 80s, but where would you say that sweater comes from?
Oh, that's a Cosby sweater.
It totally is. It is totally. we are on the same page. That is absolutely a Cosby sweater. Oh, that's awesome.
You know, which it goes along with what you said about him manipulating her mind a little bit. You know, it's all.
Oh my gosh. Well, I want to give a shout out to the colorist here on page two when Max is distraught and he's in the apartment. And the panels that McGuire and Austin put together look great, but the colorist came in here and maybe they gave him color guides. I don't know. But they're showing the blinds, right? The vertical blinds shining, yeah. The horizontal blinds shining through. And so it's hitting Max in just a very dramatic way. The coloring on his face looks just awesome. I just love that.
You know, that's the thing about Justice League over the years. You know, it's always a down moment when Max Lord is kind of in the dumps.
Yeah.
It happened a couple times where he's been sort of at a low ebb. And that's always a real mood shifter for me over the course of the series. When he's down and out, I feel down and out.
Yeah. No, that's fair. And this is something I was going to say at the end. But I'll say, for me, like, if you have to boil the Bwahaha era down to one person, it's Max for me. Like, he is the heart and soul of the team. I mean, I can make an argument for a lot of the characters, but he is so distinctly part of this era and not really part of any of the others in the same way that I feel like he is the linchpin that holds the whole thing together.
Yeah, I think the only thing that's missing is that in the last bit with the cop is that when he should have finished his sentence when he says, hey, I know your face, aren't you Sam Neill?
You know, it's funny. McGuire says, I only copied Sam Neill one time.
I know. It doesn't look like him anymore. That's why the joke works to me.
Yeah. All right. So let's keep going here. So back at the Secret Sanctuary, which is now the headquarters, Martian Manhunter tells Catherine Colbert that he is taking an extended leave of absence. Now, he still expresses how much the League means to him and how much he loves the family, but he needs to be apart from them. So she's distraught by this, but, you know, General Glory shows up and tries to cheer her up and, in fact, encourages him to sing a couple of old school, you know, 1940s songs. And she has had enough of that crap. And she's a great McGuire face of her in fury. She spins around, shoves him, which he's a big dude, right? He's a wall of muscle, but oh, she yeah. shoves him up against the wall. So angry, saying how she doesn't want to hear anything about the good old days because these are the new rotten days. And I don't know that McGuire really got a chance to draw Catherine very often, but he has really captured her. She's one of my favorite characters in the whole run. She is so phenomenal. I mean, she's smart. She's intelligent. I guess that's the same thing because I'm not smart or intelligent. Anyway, she's powerful. She's gorgeous. She's a fashion template. She's so many things. And McGuire just nailed it. He just absolutely nailed it.
You know, one thing about this issue between Catherine and Max is it's sort of the civilian characters that are the most upset with where the League has sunk to or what the condition is of their status, the UN and all that. Mm-hmm. They're very much sort of fan surrogates, reader surrogates. Hmm. The superheroes are kind of either, you know, determined to leave or in Glory's case, he's sort of not quite all there with it. You know, he's sort of in his own reality about it. It's the civilians that are the reader identifiers that are really, you know, like wound up that things have gotten so bad and that things might be coming to an end, which I thought was interesting, an interesting sort of meta commentary, really. Maybe not on purpose, but it's certainly there for me.
It's interesting. I never thought about them being as the voice of the reader because I've said over and over and over that Catherine Colbert and Sue Dibney are the smartest people on the team. I mean, they really are. They are the smartest and they're the most practical members, at least of the Europe team. I would say the same for America. But them being the voice of the audience, that could very well be. It could be, you know, Giffen and DeMatteis are slipping something in there to be like, okay, this is the voice of reason because it's coming from a real person. That could very well be.
Exactly, yeah.
As we continue on, Max is in the park, still feeling sorry for himself, and Jean shows up in one of his many disguises to sit down and talk to Max and explains to Max that Max is a true friend and that Max is the greatest asset the League has. He's trying to encourage Max to go back to the League. And as Max is saying, no, I can't do it, and he's really going through a lot of drama about what Dream Slayer did with his body. So Martian Manhunter says, okay, you know, let me know if you want to talk. Goodbye, Max. And he kind of walks off, not in a huff, but very dramatically. And Max just can't take it. He says, wait, Jean. And there's this great panel where Jean is looking out of the corner of his eye because he knows he's hooked Max. He knows he's got Max coming back to the League with just that one moment of acting as if they didn't need Max. So Max is back. Yeah. And definitely going to be coming back.
Yeah, for sure. You can see it on, it's one of those Maguire expressions that really sells the moment. No, I don't think any other artist could have sold that moment as well.
Yeah, well, he's the master of expressions. And the next page is a perfect example of, there's no dialogue in the next page. So what we're about to begin, there's a whole bunch of like 1 and 2 page, almost vignettes, really, where they check in with all the different characters from the league. Very emotional moments. Some are funny, and I'll kind of describe them real briefly. But each one is a perfect sort of way for Giffen and DeMatteis and McGuire to say goodbye to these characters. It's really quite lovely. So the first one is a single page of Blue Jay, who's a character that nobody cares about, all right?
I'm glad you said it.
This is the moment that actually makes you feel for him. He's tiny, you know, and he's sitting in front of a portrait or a photo, and he's weeping because he's looking at a picture of him when he's, you know, in happier mode. He's there with Silver Sorceress and there with Juan Jenna, and, you know, they're all dead now, right? His whole world is dead now. Everything left from his world is dead now. He's the last one. So you see him crying, and then you see just him flying away. You don't even really see it. You just see his feet and his wing, but he's flying away, and it just tells you everything you need to know. Like, we probably never should have saw Blue Jay again after this moment. This would have been the perfect last scene for him forever.
Yeah. Did we ever see him again? I don't know.
Sadly, he's in the next part of Breakdowns.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
We're just so you know, folks, this is the end of our Breakdowns coverage, because the next part is a Breakdowns postscript, which Giffen and DeMatteis had nothing to do with. And if you want to read it, go for it. It's not something I would recommend. So,
forgot all about them.
Yeah. And all it really is the setup for Justice League Spectacular. I mean, that's really all they're doing. They're just tearing everything down so they can set up for Justice League Spectacular, which I get, which is a writing tool, but that's not the way this issue leaves us. So anyway, so we continue our check-ins. You get a lovely page checking in with Elongated Man and Sue Dibney, which is so fun because it's full of love at first. It's full of laughs at first. And then suddenly it becomes about love and loss, and it becomes emotional, which, you know, they have been, Sue and Ralph, kind of a heart and soul of the league since the Detroit era, really.
Yeah, and you know, reading this page in with hindsight, knowing what's to come and...
No.
Yeah.
You can say it. That's fine.
Well, no, I mean, but I don't want to have to say it, but that's okay. It does kind of put this page in particular in a different kind of perspective than I had at the time reading it when it was new.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Less said about the better. We get a page checking in with Crimson Fox's identity over in London with the magazine. They've determined that one Crimson Fox is going to stay in America, and then the other personality will stay in the business sense running the company, but she's going to continue to defend the league with her magazine.
What a wacky setup for a character, by the way. Coexisting. That's crazy.
They just never really got a chance to explore it enough, I think is what happened. Every character is just waiting for the right story, right? And I don't know that Crimson Fox ever got her great story. I mean, the giant sandworms, that wasn't her great story.
No, I agree. Yeah. I mean, yeah, every character has potential, but she never really fulfilled hers to me.
Yeah. Then you get a page, which is kind of fun. This is putting your two hotheads together. You've got Guy Gardner demanding to be leading the Justice League, which he's been waiting for since issue one, right? I mean, the first panel of the series starts with him demanding to be the leader of the league. So here he's telling Catherine that he's going to be the new leader since Martian Manhunter is leaving. Power Girl is having none of that. So she comes in and says that he should absolutely not be the leader. Maybe it should be a woman. They get into a fight, and Catherine storms off, having enough of this childish behavior.
Yeah, this was to me a call back to issue one with Guy and the Black Canary facing off. Totally.
Yeah. And it's a good opportunity, though, to show, because, I mean, that she functions not quite like Guy Gardner, but the same hothead aspect. She functions like that over in Justice League Europe. So, I mean, it's good to pair them together, especially when you're doing, again, this sort of farewell tour of checking in with everyone.
Yeah.
Then we get this lovely page. I really love this. It's a heartwarming chat between Metamorpho, Rocket Red, and The Flash. But it's not really, folks. It is a chat between Rex, Dimitri, and Wally. Let's be very specific, the distinction. These are not superheroes. These are friends talking. They're talking about fatherhood. They're talking about families. And one thing about the Justice League Europe I've always loved is everyone uses their first names. They don't call each other, hey, Blue Beetle, hey, Fire, hey, Ice. It's Dimitri. It's Rex. It's Wally. And it's a really touching moment. And there's some nice quotes in here where, like, Dimitri explains, because to shout, to struggle, to fight, to endure each other. He's talking about him and his wife. To shout, to struggle, to fight, to endure each other's shortcomings and still love each other. To me, that's what makes a perfect family. And Wally says, but according to your definition, the Justice League is a perfect family. And Dimitri says, exactly, my friend, exactly. Which is just, it's the pitch. I don't know. It perfectly sums up how we, the reader, feel about this Justice League group.
It's great. And I want to shout out because this is a difficult character, but McGuire draws a great Flash. Mm-hmm. I'm just in these three panels, I'm like, wow, he really nails it. The body language when he runs into the scene, and then these expressions, and he sold that new costume that he was sporting at the time with the weird eye mm-hmm. lens. But McGuire just knows exactly what to emphasize and how to sell it. It's fantastic. Love it.
I like his metamorpho. He draws a very different metamorpho. Almost looks a little bit like Deadman. He did this before, I want to say, in issue 24 when he drew him as well. It's an interesting take. It looks very different, say, Bart Sears and things like that. But it's equally interesting, and I think it works because he's still bulky. You see him talking to Dimitri. He's not a small dude, but his head looks more proportional. I don't know. But I don't know art. I just know what I like.
It's the shadows around his blank eyes that sell it to me.
Yeah. No, I agree. So then moving on, we get not back to back, but we get two hilarious pages with Blue Beetle. It's six repeating panels over and over. And then the next page is pretty much the same thing again. It's Blue Beetle working on the bug. And Dimitri's kids are peppering Blue Beetle with really uncomfortable personal questions that just work great. A whole bunch of why, and then insulting him. They're an absolute hoot. I love these pages.
They're great. It's the only sort of, it's not really a gripe, but they don't really give Blue Beetle a proper ending in the context that the other characters do, which I guess it might be the point. But you don't, from these two pages, get where he's wanting to go or wanting to do, which I guess has been his problem the last, you know, couple of years in the title. But it's a great visual gag and it works. And I think the kids and the character kind of are good foils for each other in this case.
Oh, yeah. The reason why it works for me is, to me, Ted is an acrobat and a tinkerer. Like, that's where Ted should be, right? And I love to see him tinkering with the bug. So that makes me happy. And if you're doing a send-off for each character, well, you're right. We don't know the path he's on. But Ted, at least in the Justice League, should be funny. You know, it should be a funny, funny bit. And these pages are hilarious. Whereas, you know, Ralph and Sue was touching. You know, Dimitri's was touching. This one's funny as heck. And that's what I want from my Blue Beetle. So for me, it works as an ending for him in this series.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's definitely sort of a palate cleanser from the scenes around it, for sure.
Yeah. And then we get a page of Fire feeling very exhausted and downtrodden, feeling, you know, like the Justice League's been beaten down. But then the New Yorkers start celebrating her and the JLI, and it lifts her spirits. And McGuire draws Fire because, I mean, he didn't get to establish his character. This is after he was off the book, really, with her, this particular power set. And so it's interesting the way he draws the flames, almost like falling leaves, you know, coming off of her, I guess. And I don't know. It's an interesting look for her. It's very different. It works. It's equally as dramatic, but it's just very different.
Yeah. It's very unique, and it, you know, again, shows how versatile McGuire is as an artist, because, you know, he sells this kind of weirdo power that she's kind of morphed into, but he makes it work.
Yeah. Then we catch up with Maxwell Lord and Martian Manhunter. They're in a coffee shop, and Jean is trying to convince Max that he belongs with the League. And then a little later, we get a full page of John taking flight, beginning to take his leave of absence from the team and flying away, thinking goodbye. And you see New York in the background. It's absolutely beautiful. This conversation, I'll describe it then. So Max watches John leave, right? And he's contemplating his next move. And he has another moment of doubt. But then it's like flipping a switch. Like, Maxwell Lord is suddenly back, right? He's confident, he's in charge, and he's heading for the League at top speed. And it's a fun sort of evolution there. Again, where Martian Manhunter, I think he knows that Max is going to do this. And he's just, ever since we saw that sly smile, and he's just letting Max lead himself to it, really.
Yeah, he knows how to play Max. That's the dynamic almost from the beginning, is that he's got this guy's number. So whenever he has to sort of do some subtle manipulation, play on his ego or his pride or whatever, he knows exactly how to do it and when to do it. And this is just a perfect example of that dynamic.
And I love that they say that they're friends. You know, that's nice. Because I don't know that you necessarily think about it. You see Martian Manhunter's always in Max's office, right? But you don't know what they talk about in between scenes. I'm sure they're talking about their weekend or whatever, because it's the comedy, workplace comedy kind of idea. But I love the idea that they establish their friends. And the scene where Max is back, you know, where you see it switch on, there's a great echo there. He gets in a taxi cab. Now, last issue, he got in a taxi cab, and the taxi guy asked him if he's Maxwell Lord, and he says, I used to be. You know, earlier in this issue, he told the cop, I just look like him. Here, the guy starts to ask him if he's Maxwell Lord. He goes, damn right I am. Which is just, it's great. That's a very Maxwell Lord. You really feel like, oh, he really is back.
Now, I will say, I don't know exactly, but I just have a feeling that that cab driver is based on somebody at DC. And I just don't, I can't.
Quite possibly. I mean, his face is so distinct, that hair, the mustache. Yeah, probably. Yeah. Or at least someone Kevin knew in his life.
Yeah, too specific to just have been someone that McGuire just came up with on the spot.
I should have asked. Like, I've asked him on Twitter time and again, or like who, what character was. And he's been kind enough to say, oh, that was based on this or no or whatever. So, yeah. You get a page of Guy Gardner being very Guy Gardner. He's having a tantrum. He's yelling about how he's going to be the team leader, and he's looking for Catherine Colbert, and he's stomping around. And then he overhears his beloved Ice. You know, Tora is crying. And Guy's softer side comes out, right? And he knows that he needs to comfort Tora. And then he does a quick heel turn, but not until after he's finished yelling at Catherine Colbert, which is it really kind of sums up Guy and Ice's relationship. It doesn't give you the happy ending you want with them, but, you know, we don't need that. We're still in act two for their relationship, if you will. And they need to have that distance and him keep screwing it up.
Yeah, it's the right moment for those two at this point. Because that, you know, again, going back a ways, it was a funny gag that went on too long when Guy bumped his head and became like, you know, Mr. Nice Guy for eight issues or however long it was. So you want to see these quick turns now. You know, you want to see him have the moment, but it only lasts a moment. And he just goes right back to being an ass. You
know? Yeah.
That just feels right to me.
And Guy's the other character, I would argue, is, you know, if you take Maxwell Lord off the table, who's the single most definable character of the JLI? I feel like it's Guy, just because he had such a interesting journey. I mean, he became more prominent, certainly. I mean, he was just a guy in Green Lantern. You know, not everyone knew him. But here he became not a household name, but at least if you were a DC fan, you all knew who he was because of this book. And he had an interesting journey where he was an ass in the front. He stayed an ass throughout. But there was those moments where he cared about the team, like legitimately went to go save Oberon or went to go save Blue Beetle or whoever. And you'd be like, wait a minute, he cares. Interesting. So he can be an ass and still care. And I don't know. I'm glad he got this moment because I don't know. I needed to see more Guy towards the end here.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%.
So for my money, the book ends on the absolute perfect scene. So here we go. Final scene of the Giffen DeMatteis era. Catherine Colbert and Sue Dibny, again, the smartest and most reasonable members of the entire league. They have come to the realization that they just don't have enough money to keep the league going. You know, between the payroll and the overhead expenses, there just isn't enough funds to support the league without the United Nations. And they know the members aren't greedy for taking a salary. They still got to, you know, buy groceries, so they're not being greedy. So Crimson Fox offers to subsidize some of the expenses with her company, but it's still not going to be enough. And they consider corporate sponsorship, but they don't want to become corporate puppets like the conglomerate. So they lament the old days when Maxwell Lord acquired the support of the United Nations. And a voice is heard off-panel saying, and why he just might do it again. And the final page, again, of the Giffen DeMatteis era of Justice League, features a full-page splash of Maxwell Lord, adorned in his traditional business suit and chomping on a cigar. And along with him is Oberon, also decked out in a business suit. And Max says, what do you say we get to work? Fasten your seatbelts, kiddies. It's going to be a bumpy ride. And that, I mean, I didn't think I was going to get emotional. I've read this comic before. Why would I get emotional? And it's not like the podcast is ending. We got another 9 months. But this page, it felt like such a springboard. It felt like, damn, it is about to happen. This is going to be the greatest rebuilding story ever coming next. I don't know if you got that feeling as well, but it just ended perfectly for me.
Yeah, I mean, I just go back to that word bittersweet, because in this one page, in this one image, there's all that potential is right there. And, you know, as a reader, you just want them to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Because it suggests that they have something in mind. Now, they had nothing in mind.
Right.
This is what's known as a handoff, and a very generous handoff to the next creative team. So, but as a reader, without that, you know, sort of behind the curtain insight, you just feel like, wow, they could go another, you know, year, 2 years, 3 years, who knows? But, you know, sadly, that was not to be the case. But they did a great for whoever was going to come after them by leaving them with this.
Yeah. And for us, you know, it works fine because we're going to stop here, you know, with this issue. And then when we join these folks again, you know, we're going to be doing the formerly known as Justice League, which is a great point to pick back up. So We don't, and don't get me wrong, there's some great stories in there, and all those creators were working their hearts out. I'm not trying to say they weren't, but they just weren't this, you know, and that's fine. They were trying to define their own era, and, you know, everyone likes what they like, is another way to say it, I guess.
That's right. That's right. I'm just glad that, you know, we got this issue with all the original guys, creators coming back and doing it one last time, because that's rare. I mean, it's a testament to how special they knew this book was, because, you know, McGuire didn't have to come back, obviously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that he did speaks to he knew this was a big deal. I think everybody knew it was a big deal. And I will say that what's interesting about this, the timing of this issue's release, you said it came out in January of 1992. Mm-hmm. That's only 3 months before the first issue of Youngblood, which was the first Image comic.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
So it really is sort of a handoff of in a generational sense, which I think is very telling, because, you know, Justice League, one of its hallmarks was its style of storytelling. And it was really storytelling over everything else. It didn't, you know, it had great artists, but it wasn't ever considered an art book. It had great writing, but wasn't considered a writer's book. It was a total package that had everything to do with storytelling. Again, going back to Keith's vision of how he made this book from issue to issue. And, there was not a comic book like this after this ended, because a different, you know, the torch was passed in a different way to that Image generation. And that brought in a whole new style of comics that was obviously being cultivated at Marvel at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the debut of Image Comics really solidified a different style of comic. So it seems fitting that that this ends here, and the next wave of how to tell superhero comic book stories begins just 3 months later.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, because you're right. I mean, the big two spend the next probably 6, 7, 10 years chasing what Image, you know, launch from there. And mm-hmm. So you're right. This is kind of the end of this type of storytelling. Wow. I hadn't thought of, man, look at you with the big brain. Almost like you think about how things are written for a living. Huh? Interesting.
I don't. Yes. I sometimes have a thought that counts. You know, I will say this, you know, guys of my generation who were influenced by this stuff and watched the Image Comics ethos kind of happen. When I broke in, it was just 5 years after this comic came out. It was my first published stuff at Marvel. This was my aesthetic. Mm. This is what I tried to bring to the comics that I was doing at the time. So what I, you know, while it seemed like it was just taking a turn away from what Image had been doing for the previous 5 years, to me, I was just doing the type of comic book that I loved growing up, which I guess is how these things work. These cycles kind of work like that, you know?
Oh, yeah. I would say into the 2000s, I think because this is not to take anything away from the Image guys, but, you know, it was about the spectacle. It was about the look, the explosive art, the amazing. It wasn't so much about the character development. It was about what was on the page. And whereas this storytelling is more about the character development. And then by the time you get to the 2000s, I feel like we went back into a cycle of character development. I mean, look at, you know, what James Robinson was laying down with Starman and things like that. And you get back to a point where the writers are focusing on character. And, you know, speaking of character, all right, so the last page of this, I'm over here, I won't stop cheerleading it, right? But on the page, it's Max and Oberon. Neither one of these characters are technically on the Justice League. Neither one have powers, but the writing and the storytelling made you care about them as characters so much so that them being on the last page was a reason to celebrate. So that's a good example of, as you said, this different type of storytelling where a guy in a business suit is the guy you want to cheer for, not the guy in the super suit. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's very 80s in a way, but, you know,
yeah,
endemic of this book. And it's interesting that I don't remember breakdowns well enough to know. Does Oberon just coming out of nowhere at this point?
Completely out of nowhere. Yeah. We haven't seen him in a long time because basically they just kind of substituted Elrond for Oberon for a long time. Right. And and also they were doing some stuff in Mr. Miracle where they kind of needed Oberon to go off into space. So he kind of left the book there. And then he just didn't really come back because they had Elrond. So I think this is the first time we've seen Oberon in a long time.
That's very interesting. Cause I mean, it's another example of, you know, Giffen and DeMatteis detaching a character from their roots and appropriating them in a way that made it seem this reappearance here seems totally natural.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, he's back where he belongs, as opposed to being Mr. Miracle's sidekick, which is what he was created to be.
It's funny. I wasn't even familiar with Mr. Miracle when I started reading this book, or at least the depth of it, you know? So I had no idea Oberon belonged over there. You know, to me, he was a Justice League guy, sort of like Kilowog. I mean, I knew he had been part of the Green Lanterns, but for me, he was part of the Justice League. He was the handyman. And like you said, they appropriated different things. I mean, even the very first issue, and someone had to point this out to me, so I can't claim the credit for this. So this is post-Legends, right? As you said, the people are on the team. You get Shazam, Dr. Fate, Blue Beetle, Mr. Miracle, all of them in pre-crisis are different worlds. Earth, you know, Earth S, Earth 2, Earth, I can't remember what the Charlton world was, whatever it was. You know, Mr. Miracle's off in the fourth world. So they were appropriating all these different characters from different disparate components and corners of the DC universe to build this team. So they've kind of been about building from different building blocks since the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, that was always the great thing about Justice League, this incarnation. It really, to me, it was always where the nexus of the DC universe is where all the different things that had been consolidated through Crisis on Infinite Earths finally came together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the book where all these disparate characters found common ground. There was cohesion there. And again, the cohesion of those characters all comes down to the execution, and that comes down to the creators. And, you know, these guys were just top of their game on this book.
Oh, yeah. In fact, speaking of that, the letters page, they did away with the letters page for this issue and gave it entirely to J.M. DeMatteis. And he gets to write a nice, long, long goodbye, essentially. Yeah. And he talks about how he got the job, how he didn't want the job. I mean, he's told us some of this here on the show in person, but how he didn't want the job and how his relationship with Kiffin grew. And I mean, reading it now that Giffen's gone, is even more kind of wonderful, like, I guess. Is that the way to say it? I don't know. It just means more now. You know, you read it a little differently. And it's powerful. And then he mentions, I thought this was interesting, at the time at least, his favorite characters to write were Martian Manhunter and Blue Beetle. Thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting, yeah. I mean, it's also interesting that, you know, according to both of them, their real friendship was cultivated years after they worked on this book together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their time on the book was a very much a working relationship, a close working relationship, but nonetheless a working relationship. And it was only later they became like real friends, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah. And they didn't even know. I mean, I assume they knew, but they didn't appreciate what they had created until years later. Like when they looked back and them and the three with Kevin and realized, you know, we did something pretty amazing. I mean, again, taking Justice League, launching it into this massive franchise. I mean, not just these books, but all the spinoffs and everything too. Like, you know, Mr. Miracle had his own series, Dr. Fate, all these people. They really did something amazing. And for a while there, the fans sort of turned their back on these books, right? You know, suddenly became, oh, it was the Joke League. They didn't like it. Boo, you know, moving on from that. But it wasn't until probably formerly known as the Justice League that everyone suddenly woke up and went, you know what? Actually, we did love those books back then. They were really good. And finally, they started celebrating them.
Yeah. Well, I think, like I said, it was also my generation of creators that came in the late 90s, early aughts that had grown up on these books and still held them dear to our hearts. We now had the platform to pay tribute to them and, you know, sing their praises when when I would be asked, what did you read growing up? What were your favorite comics as a kid or as a teenager? This was always on the list, and I was the only one. So it was one of those things where its fans had to break into the business, which took a couple of years to really, you know, sort of start to bring it back. And I think that's always, again, paying it forward. You've always got to pay tribute to the things that got you where you are. And I don't think there is a superhero writer of my generation that doesn't have this series as part of their DNA. I mean, it's just, there's no way. People that write comics that are of my age group, we all love this comic book.
That is an amazing observation. Yeah, it took the fans breaking in to make people re-examine how great these books were. So thank you. Thank you very much to you and all your contemporaries then, sir.
My and our pleasure.
Well, I think we've already answered this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I've done this on every episode about Breakdowns, so this is our 15th time doing this. Breakdowns has a very divisive reputation. You know, some folks love it, which I've heard a lot of people sing its praises, actually, in the comment section, and then other people, you know, have hard feelings about it. So looking at this issue in a microcosm, and then we can talk about Breakdowns as a bigger whole, does this issue earn that bad reputation, or is it better than most people may remember?
I think this issue really sticks the landing. I think I sort of agree with Giffen's sort of post-game assessment that, I mean, he admitted years later that it probably went on a little too long.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what are you going to do? I'd rather have more than less.
Yeah.
But this issue in particular, the fact that they got McGuire back, it stands alone. They did it, you know, and I didn't reread any of breakdowns to prepare for this podcast. So, but I got all the context I needed from just the first couple of pages. So This issue stands alone as a finale. It did really, you know, it could have gotten away with not having the breakdowns branding on the cover and still worked fine as a final issue. So you know, while the storyline might have its flaws, the ending is, to me, pretty flawless.
I co-sign everything you just said. I mean, what an amazing wrap-up. A five-year run, and this issue, I mean, from all the writing, the whether it be the plot or the script or the pencils and inks, it just sings. It's just beautiful. It's, you, as you said, you can read it by itself and get everything you need. It is an absolute success. I don't know that we need to talk more about breakdowns as a whole because we've already done that earlier on. Yeah, this issue absolutely ended perfectly. And I think it was the perfect ending for the Giffen DeMatteis run. Absolutely loved it. So I got to ask you, every episode we do this thing where we nominate the
Wahaha Award.
This is where we nominate the funniest moment in the issue. Both myself and my guest pick one moment to be awarded the coveted Waha Award. I've got my pick in mind. Do you happen to have a favorite moment in this book that you think is just, maybe it's a soft chuckle, maybe it's a big old belly laugh? Is there a moment here that you just think's the funniest?
Well, it's a weird one. After Martian Manhunter being so loquacious over the course of the series and the banter with, you know, Max and the other characters and having to deal with all the insanity, the fact that his farewell page is one word,
mm-hmm.
I always got a kick out of that.
Oh, okay.
It was sort of like the expectation would be that he would make some big speech, and he just says goodbye. So I always got a kick out of that.
That's interesting. I didn't see any humor in that, as I just felt the emotional, you know, the farewell sadness, but I hadn't thought about the contrast. Yes.
As a writer is where I get the chuckle out of it.
Sure. That
defying the narrative expectation of what John's character's been for so long.
I imagine this is Bob LePayne's favorite page he ever worked on for Martian Manhunter.
Yeah.
My pick was a little more straightforward in the comedy. I picked the two Blue Beetle pages together. I am a sucker for when you set up a joke and then you do a callback and you deliver on at the end. I'm a sucker for the repeating panels when it works. So I just felt like this was prime Giffen DeMatteis McGuire type humor, and it's what it worked for me. That's what sang as humorously for me. So typically we battle it out to see which one wins, but I don't feel like it right now. Let's just give it to both of them. Blue Beetle and Martian Manhunter both can win the coveted Bwahaha Award. So Ted and Jean, please wear the award with pride. It is as tangible as the laughter we give the moment. So now, Joe, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging around here at the Secret Sanctuary for just a bit and packing away all the Justice League International stuff for good and kind of shutting off the lights on this whole original Giffen DeMatteis run?
I can do that. It would be my pleasure and my honor.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. And don't worry, we are going to bring you back into the show. After this podcast promo break, I'm going to bring in an important part of the show, which is the feedback from you folks at home.
Siskoid watches a lot of movies, like a lot. So now he has his own movie podcast, or several. Siskoid Cinema is your one-stop umbrella for a variety of shows like Fade In, exploring the first films of famous actors and directors.
This is a joke, right?
On Borrowed Time, discussing all your favorite time travel movies.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
And No Escape from Kurt Russell, a dissection of the man, the mystique, and the movies.
There goes a perfectly good bumper sticker.
And more, Siskoid Cinema, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Justice Law.
All right, folks, just remember, we may be done with the original run of JLI by Giffen and DeMatteis, but there is a lot more to cover, specifically JLI-related stuff written by Giffen and DeMatteis that we're going to be covering in the coming months. So stay tuned. We've still got a lot ahead of us. And we've got a little bit of news coming out of James Gunn's new DC movies. Maxwell Lord has been cast for the DCU, going to be played by Sean Gunn, be playing Maxwell Lord. And a lot of people kind of were hemming and hawing, going, oh, what, another villain? And James Gunn posted on social media, he wrote, quote, "Calling Maxwell Lord a villain seems reductionist, as he was originally portrayed in the JLI, made him one of my favorite characters," end quote. Whoa, that is fantastic. James Gunn giving a huge shout out to JLI. So that is very encouraging to hear about that. Now remember, folks, get on the social media, tag JLI Podcast. As I always say, it's about building a community of JLI fans around the show. And remember, when you're posting your comments, if you're outside the United States, let me know, and we will assign you the appropriate embassy. So for this, we're pulling our comments from our website, email, social media, stuff like that, just pulling bits and pieces because we've got a tremendous amount of feedback. And we are covering specifically the most recent episode featuring Justice League America number 59 with my guest Mark Baker Wright and Justice League Europe number 35, our last issue of Justice League Europe ever to cover with my guest Tim Price. And when I say we have a lot of feedback, I collected all the feedback from last episode in a Google Doc, folks, and it's 27 pages of feedback. I kid you not. So I'm going to race through this as quick as I can, just hitting a lot of the highlights. So first up is Damian Drew A. Whiter from the England Embassy in the Should I Love This Comic podcast. He says, "Just listening to Shag's comments on the inking in the JLA issue, and I'm surprised a dyed-in-the-wool JL Detroit and Suicide Squad fan did not recognize the uncredited inking assist by Luke McDonnell, particularly obvious on the splash panel reveal of the new Extremist. There's something quite satisfying about seeing the artist of J.M. DeMatteis' End of an Era run on JLA turning up on his penultimate issue of JLA." Wow. Okay, that's fascinating, Damian. Now, I'm just curious, is that speculation based on what you're seeing and with a level of confidence, or has it been confirmed that Luke McDonnell helped ink this issue? I'd love to know the details. Then we'll hear from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and Other Stories. He asked about Firestorm, because my guest and I were discussing Firestorm in detail, and I'm not going to get into the specifics of the question, because it's not really relevant to JLI, but thank you for your question, and thankfully, Mark Baker Wright, my guest last episode, stepped in with all the Firestorm knowledge bomb to answer Rob's question. All right, moving on, Bucky749, who has his own YouTube channel, Bucky's got Wrestling on the Brain and Ultraverse. Again, not going to address that right now, because it's not specific to the JLI, but thank you for the comment, Bucky. We always appreciate your support. Then for Michael Kramer, who says, I think the Blue Beetle Metamorpho joke was the better of the two choices. So he's referring to the Bwahaha award we gave out last time. So he thought the Blue Beetle Metamorpho joke was better than the cover. Michael goes on to say, I mean, the cover, here's another fine thing, is funny, but with all due respect, it's still a repurposing of someone else's work. The paid by the chuckle, and that's why you're broke gag, feels, if not more original, then at least more organic. It's the kind of banter my friends and I would actually have on the spot rather than talking in famous quotes. Well, Michael, I appreciate your input. Thank you so much, and I appreciate your opinion. I will say that talking in movie quotes is basically the way me and my friends entirely communicate. Bad call, Ripley. Bad call. So, I'm all for talking in movie quotes. It's like the verbal form of a GIF, really, is kind of what it is. Anyway, thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. Then from Gus Casals from the Argentina Embassy, he has podcasts such as Ian Reed's Crisis and the Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and more. Gus says, I was listening and at the same time screaming out loud, the Bwahaha is the cover. Good thing you heard me. So Gus agrees with me about the cover rather than the other joke. All right, so I'm feeling a little vindication here. And he says, as for the final splash page, some of us would have loved to have had the big, hairy Russian in a loincloth. Just saying. Oh, Gus, never change. I adore you. Then he says, I did have a Silver Age choke moment at the announcement that this was the final JLE issue to be covered. Thy end is nigh, fellow travelers. Well, true. Very true. Then Tim Price, of course, our guest last episode, does the Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders podcast and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. He chimes in, following up on Gus's comments, saying, in my humble opinion, the only thing worth discussing on JLE number 36, so that was the following issue, the breakdowns postscript that we didn't cover, he says, the only thing worth covering in that issue is the cover, since it was by Maguire, and I like it quite a bit. It makes a great bookend to Justice League number 1's cover. But you had a hard stop at the cover. No entry. entry, do not pass go, nothing to see here. Yeah, I completely agree, Tim. After rereading that issue, no, there's nothing inside those pages for us fans of the Giffen DiMattea era. Tim goes on to say, if I may, following up on the discussion about Max, I'd like to take a moment to honor the other normal person in the cast, Catherine Colbert. Here's a woman whose first appearance in JLI number 8 was primarily to be a cliché beauty with a thick French accent, and set up big laughs at Booster's expense. And thanks to regular appearances in the JLE, we got to see how smart and brave and witty and competent she was, quickly becoming the real leader of that team. Catherine was another great character in the series, and I'm glad the creators treated her well here. And her hair can be as big as she wants because she's Catherine freaking Colbert. Yes, I would completely agree. Then Mark Baker Wright chimes in. Of course, he was our guest last episode. He does Black Rock's Toy Box and the Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Mark says, regarding Catherine Colbert, I will miss her contributions to the DC Universe, and not just for the right reasons Shag keeps telling us about. Does she ever show up post-blah-ha-ha? It's a good question. Now, in my defense, Mark, I say a lot of nice things about Catherine, not just the fact that she's beautiful. I talk about all of her attributes. She is the entire package. Following up Mark's question, Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, of Time Problems, says Catherine does show up post-Bwahaha era, though she and Max are nowhere near as prominent as they once were. The writers who took over were seemingly much less interested in these non-powered characters being main characters like they were. I have no idea what became of Catherine later, and if she's even around in the present-day DCU, though apparently someone on the Young Justice cartoon's creative team is a JLI fan, because both Catherine and Dimitri made appearances on that show. Yeah, I was aware that Catherine had appeared on Young Justice. Jason goes on to say, I liked Justice League Europe a lot, and I still think that initial lineup of Captain Atom, Flash, Rocket Red, Power Girl, Animal Man, Metamorpho, and Elongated Man is one of the best superhero team lineups ever. I would like to remind you, Jason, if you're talking about the initial lineup, that would include Wonder Woman for exactly four panels. Anyway, Jason goes on to say, their hijinks as Americans trying to fit in living in Europe were really resonated with me as an army brat who lived in Germany. The Bart Sears art was great, though I liked the inking on the early issues better. Then Jason says, I didn't like the mass killings of the Kui natives. The whole concept of the island and its people was always played for lighthearted laughs. I mean, who can forget the chief being a big Love Boat fan, and at the prospect of meeting Gavin McLeod got him on board with the JLI casino. So it was jarring to see it run up against the grim storytelling like this. Also with it being the place Silver Sorceress meets her end. And speaking of which, her sacrifice in taking down Dreamslayer is one of the most memorable parts of Breakdowns. She has a lot in common with the Legion's Pharaoh lad, more famous for how she died than anything she did before that. Ooh, interesting comparison. I like that. That's very interesting. They were from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, what? They dismissed the Great Beefeater? How rude. This is a true injustice. It's very vexing. How can they besmirch his good name? Well, thank you, Liz. Again, I'm always a fan of the supporters of Beefeater. That's great. Then Liz says, Catherine Colbert's hair is fine. It reminds me of the Elvira action figure I just bought. I about died when I read that, because you're right. Catherine's hair is crazy tall. I mean, it looks ludicrous, right, in the art. It's fun in the comic book, and if you try to make it real, it'd look ludicrous. And then once I read your comment, I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, it would absolutely look like Elvira's hair. So fantastic observation, Liz. So thank you. They are from Symbol Pending from the England Embassy, does the Power Girl blog called Symbol Pending. They say, when you think about it, the choice to end on the story of Silver Sorceress is a weird one. A good chunk of the other characters were not only sidelined, they're made into bad guys, and the fight is made a sideline to a rather small-scale battle to more or less end this epic storyline. Though that's probably us, or me, looking back on this at the end of an epic run, rather than just a mundane changing of the writers. Personally, as a fan of underdog characters, I really enjoy the story, but I wonder if it's maybe why some might have a problem with Breakdowns as a whole. You know, that makes a good point, Symbol Pending. Like, going into this, I didn't even remember that Dream Slayer and Silver Sorceress had an epic battle at the end at all. So, yeah, I mean, maybe you make a good point. Maybe the big resolution should have been the regulars. I don't know. Then Symbol Pending says, you know, tailing of Dream Slayer's influence, I'm surprised that no one has tried to tie that into the heel turn of Max. Even if it was from a basic desire to never be placed in a position to never lose control like that again, but with a little bit of Dream Slayer floating around pushing Max to step over the line to become a full villain, actually it wouldn't be a terrible way to do a redemption arc for the character. Yeah, I mean, actually they could totally pull a Hal Jordan Parallax thing. where they said that Parallax was some entity living inside of him, and that's what made Hal Jordan evil. And Hal Jordan was, you know, completely innocent in this. They could totally do the same thing for Maxwell Lord. Yeah, great idea. All right, then we heard from Siskoid from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, also from the Canadian Embassy, and his show Who's Editing just wrapped up, but he's also got a ton of other shows, including FW Team Up and many more. Siskoid says, it's a testament to the creative team's artistry that Silver Sorcerer's sacrifice still works, considering she's the poster child for the quote, "We hardly knew ya," but it does work. And then he says, and given what comes next, the JLE kind of dies with her. Ouch! That is a fair but brutal observation, Siskoid. Then we heard from Nuno Duarte from the Portuguese Embassy, who says, rereading these breakdowns issues has been a roller coaster, since the story isn't as bad as I remembered, but the inherent bleakness of the whole narrative feels contrived compared to the early issues of the Giffen DiMatteis era. And he says, can't wait to hear the Bwahaha podcast's take on formerly known as the Justice League, and I can't believe it's not the Justice League, since they're wonderful celebrations of the title by the original team of creators. Yeah, Nuno, we are so excited about getting to those stories, and looking forward to really diving into those wonderful reunion stories. Then we heard from Alan Boyce, who says, I'm of the age that I should have been buying these issues, but didn't start reading until we found this show. Thank you for introducing me. Aw, Alan, that's incredibly kind of you to say, and I'm always so excited to find someone who tries JLI later in life. So I'm glad to hear you're enjoying it. Then we heard from Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcasting Network. He has a blog and a podcast based on Martian Manhunter called Idlehead of Diablo and a lot of other stuff. Frank says, I have, at times, had complete runs of JLA and JLE, but I think I managed to partially divest myself of chunks without ever bothering to read them, especially the JLE. Silver Sorceress meant nothing, in all caps. Silver Sorceress meant nothing to me, so her dying from an arrow fired by a random Kui 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 native sounds about right. Then later he goes on to say, Derek Robertson is really doing the work to put Silver Sorceress over, and I think that's a failing in the plot. For one, we all love Zatanna, despite her not getting all that many opportunities to show off in the league. Imagine her on the team getting a dramatic moment like this instead of the Cashew Conjuress. Next, having put in that work, wouldn't the story have been better if she'd lived? This was a character going in with absolutely no fan following, being hard-sold in her final moments before being deposited in the refrigerator. Silver Sorceress was a stunt and a bid for unearned gravitas at the end of a story in a book defined by laughs rather than tears, and it seems to anticipate the shock death of another frosted-haired Justice Leaguer heroine in a few years later. Ooh, yeah, please don't remind me about the death of Ice. Ugh. Then he goes on to sing the praises of several artists. I'm not going to read what he wrote, but just to name-check some of those artists that he liked. Shockingly, I agree with all these. I like these artists, too. Mike McCone, I thought he was very good. Chuck Wojciechowicz, with the CW name, it's easy to confuse that with Chris Wozniak, but they're two completely different people and very different artists. And the last one that I wanted to mention that he name checks is Kevin West, who I also really dug his work on Justice League. So, shockingly, I agree with Frank, and I think that says a lot about me, which is kind of scary. Then we're from Martin Gray from the Scotland Embassy in the Too Dangerous for Girl blog. Martin says, gosh, we're nearly at the end of the JLI runs. It's beginning to feel very real. Happily, we know a whole world of JSA shows will follow. Yay! Yes, that is right. Thank you, Martin, for the promotion there. Just a reminder there, Justice Society Presents podcast is going to start being monthly. As soon as the JLI podcast ends, we'll be covering lots of JSA goodness. It's going to be a blast. In fact, to help keep the JSA Presents feed warm, we've got an episode coming just next week on Christmas Eve. So check that out. Then Martin says, I get Mark's bit about Max's powers expanding under Dreamslayer's influence and staying stronger, but what if residual Dreamslayer was then responsible for getting Max to the point of murdering Ted Kord? Maybe a little bit of Dreamslayer was left behind? Think Doc Ock and Superior Spider-Man? Very good, Martin. Obviously, you and Symbol Penning are thinking in sync, both kind of touching on the same ideas there. That would be a fun way to redeem Max and get him back, if continuity even mattered, which I don't know if it does anymore. But anyway, and he says, as regards to Justice League Group number 35, Tim worked blooming hard to bring forth 1990s X-Men from a bunch of coconuts and some string. Then again, Kui 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 is a living island like Krakoa. Ah, there you go, there you go. There's a little bit of X-Men going on there. Then we heard from Chris Pine, who crashed the dentist convention to steal free drinks and appetizers. Chris says, mind battles in comics follow the logic laid out by Dreamscape and Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm shocked you guys are questioning it. That's fair. That is absolutely fair. I like that. Yeah, those should be the template for all mind fights, right? Then Chris goes on to say, now that we're at the end, I thought I'd share my own JLI origin story. He says, I was a Marvel kid growing up, and most of that grew out of the Spider-Man and the Electric Company. I bought comics from the Spinnerack at my local 7-Eleven, and one day my father took me to the collectible store, and my mind was blown. So many comics. About a year later, I was 10, and my father arranged for me to work Saturdays at the comic shop. They paid me in breakfast sandwiches, deli lunches, and comic books, which I think is technically a federal crime. Then one day, the owner's brother shoved the Dark Knight Returns into my hands and told me to take it home. When I said I didn't read DC, he said he didn't care. It was going to be very important. Soon after, I started collecting Batman, but that was kind of weird and like a soap opera then at the 80s. Anyway, I was just about to drop DC and go back to just reading Marvel, but I saw a John Byrne cover with DC characters on it. And that was weird. Why was a Marvel guy doing over DC? So I picked up issue number one of Legends, and then everything in DC was starting over. And I was the kid who worked on Flash number one? Sure. Blue Beetle? The Question? Man of Steel? Fine. If it's a number one, I'll get it. Legends led to the Giffen DeMatteis Justice League, and man, that first issue was everything I didn't know I wanted from a comic book. It was funny, a little somber, it had action, it had someone who was a real jerk in it. I mean, think about it, a main character was a complete jerk, and we kind of loved him for it. That isn't supposed to work. They were already world-building and dropping little hints in the mystery with Max. The art was like nothing I'd ever seen before, and everyone had their own personality, which is really hard to pull off. Not many team books could do that. For example, I love Claremont's X-Men, but a lot of his characters talk the same. The dialogue could have been interchangeable, swap out some German for Russian, and there isn't much else there. But with the JLI, everyone has a unique, somewhat relatable individual personality. Maybe it was the humor, or perhaps the idea of setting most of the comic in between action where they could really explore characters and not have everyone become an exposition machine. You could never confuse Beetle for Rocket Red, or Oberon, or Jean, or Guy, or Scott. I don't even know if I ever read another comic book where the characters came to life like that. It's the main reason why this run is probably my favorite in all of comics. Oh, great points, Chris. I really appreciate that. And thanks for sharing your origin story. I love those. Those are always so great. All right, folks, now this is going to be the part where we thank everyone who shared the show on their social media timeline. That includes Facebook, Twitter, Blue Sky. It's a long list of names. I am aware of that. That is not a surprise to me. However, these folks showed their support and promoted the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. A lot of these people are going to be named. This is going to be the only time that they're going to get name checked in the show. So, but they are part of our family, and I want to say thank you. So here's everyone who helped promote the last episode by sharing on Facebook or retweeting on Twitter or whatever the heck you do on Blue Sky. So our thanks go out to Alan E. Boyce Jr., Andre TFG, Bill, a.k.a. The Bat Pod, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook page, Brian Schufo, Canadian Geek, Chris Franklin, Chris Lydon, Chris Pine, Chris Wales, Christopher Luke, Craig McD, Damian Drew A. Whiter, Dave's Comic Heroes Blog, David Ace Gutierrez, DC All-Stars Podcast, Diablo Frank, Doug Adamson, Dr. Pop Culture, Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine, Edwin Billiott, Frederico Hernandez, Gus Casals, Jake Muir, Jason R. Lady, J.P. Roca, Justice Trek, Keechee Baker, Connell, Crazy Joe Adventures, Liz Ann Oswald, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Matthew Cody, Max Romero, Maxwell Traver, Ma Zinger 1978, Michael Kramer, Michael Thomas, Mike Dynas, Mr. Tommy G., Mo Walker, Nicholas Alheim, Nuno Duarte, Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders, Patrick's Tactics and Tutorials, Pragmatic Golem, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Rob Kelly, Ryan Cheshire, Scott X, Sean Ross, the Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, S. Matthew Stolte, Super Lad Kid, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Voice of Paul, Tim Price, Trent Lewis, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Willie Yarbrough, and Zach Kep Boots. Woof, man. Thank you so much to all of you for your support of the JLI Podcast. You know, your feedback is a critical part of the show, and this community of JLI fans we're building together is absolutely amazing. I adore all of you. And if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Mark Baker Wright or Tim Price. So if I did miss you, just let me know, and I'll be sure to include you in the next episode. And please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. Visit our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI and leave your comment there. That's where most of the action's going on. But you can also find us on Facebook as JLI Podcast or Justice League International Blahaha Podcast, on Twitter as JLI Podcast, and on Blue Sky as FW Podcasts. And you can email us at JLIPodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to Mark Baker Wright and Tim Price for appearing on the most recent episode of the show, and thanks to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll reconnect with Joe Casey. Dr. Fate.
Dr. Midnight.
Starman.
Johnny Quick.
Wildcat.
Power Girl.
The All-Star Squadron.
Firebrand.
Amazing Man.
Huntress.
Cyclone.
Sandman.
Mr. Terrific.
Star
Commander Steel.
Seven Soldiers of Liberty.
Infinity Incorporated.
Those are just some of the celebrated and beloved heroes associated with Earth 2 and the Justice Society of America.
These daring mystery men and women banded together in 1940 to form the first super team in comics.
They inspired a decades-long legacy of heroes who would follow in their footsteps, and now they've inspired us to launch a new podcast.
Justice Society Presents, a new anthology on the Fire & Water Podcast Network featuring a variety of theme shows with different hosts celebrating some of their favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond.
Join the fight for justice and subscribe to Justice Society Presents on the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
All right, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we have got the amazing Mr. Joe Casey back with us again. Joe, thank you so much for appearing on the show and being here for your second time. Well, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of your work?
Well, right now I've got a creator-owned series from Image coming out called Junior Baker, The Righteous Faker, which is a sequel series to The Butcher Baker, The Righteous Maker from about a decade ago. Kneel Before Zod from DC begins in January. And Dutch from Image Comics begins in February. So a lot of superhero goodness coming from me.
You are everywhere someone wants to be. That's awesome. So if I remember right, you're not on social media. Is that correct?
Correct.
Gosh, why over the past few years would you not want to be on social media? I don't get it, Joe. That's crazy.
I've really been missing out. I can tell you that.
Well, again, Joe, thank you so much for and this has been a really incredibly special issue, not just because it's the farewell of issue 60, but it's also getting a chance to really spend some time talking about Keith. And I really appreciate you being here.
I'm thrilled to do it. He deserves every laudit we can give him. He was one of the best, and we're going to miss him.
And thank you for sharing your own personal stories there, too.
Sure.
All right, folks. Well, that is going to do it. Now, remember, we may have finished the original Gift and Damian Hayes run, but we've got a lot more to cover. In fact, next episode, we're going to cover three JLI stories that Giffen was involved with. From 1998, we're going to cover JLA 80-Page Giant number 1, the story with Giffen and McGuire featuring Booster and Beetle called Mouse Busters. Then from 2008, we're going to cover Justice League Unlimited number 43 with a story by Giffen featuring the blue and the gold in the style of the JLU animated series. It was called Wannabes. And then from 2011, we're going to cover DC Retroactive JLA the 90s with a story by Giffen, DeMatteis, and McGuire featuring the Injustice League in a story called Apocalypse No. And we'll have three more guest hosts to help me cover the issues. Who will they be? Well, come on, folks. You've been doing this for 8 years. You know how this works. You're going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Joe.
And you've been listening to the JLI Podcast.
Want to make something of it?